Yeah, I like talking about drugs and how they work. I wanted to be a little more ambitious with this this talk, though, and I brought in this what it means. So I want to put into context, how these drugs work and what they do for us. I did say in my summary that I do licit and illicit, but I'm going to focus on the illicit, because those have been in the media a lot lately. And at the end of my summary, I said, how can we tell which information we're told is true? And that's a spoiler alert. I don't have a real answer. It's more like a journey. I want to promote critical thinking about drug information and give a medical perspective on this. My slides are kind of low effort, but that's okay. The brain is a network of neurons. Our consciousness has neural correlates, and psychoactive drugs affect consciousness by affecting this network and how the nerve cells communicate. So how this happens is there's a gap in between the neurons. Well, an electrical signal goes through the neuron, and then there's a gap, and that signal has to get across somehow. And so we have the presynaptic neuron has molecules called neurotransmitters that it has in these vesicles here, stores them. And then when the signal goes to that neuron, it releases those neurotransmitters into the synapse. And then on the other side, there are receptors. And it's not illustrated here, but the receptors actually go all the way through the cell membrane on the other side. So the neurotransmitters are binding on the outside. And then on the inside of the cell, stuff happens. And then not shown here is on the presynaptic neuron, there's also reuptake pumps that take back the neurotransmitters back into it, so it can be a cycle where neurotransmitters are released and get back. But these are, like, here's kind of where we see the hacking opportunities with drugs. We can use drugs that bind to the receptors or bind and affect any point of this cycle here, and it'll make changes in how the brain communicates and change our perceptions and consciousness. And an example would be, I'll start with opioids. We have a receptor called the mu opioid receptor, and opioids bind to those, and it modulates pain. It also is sedating. They slow breathing, reduce air hunger, and in overdose, they slow breathing too much, and so you don't get enough oxygen, and you don't really care because there's no air hunger. People get conked out. There's an antidote, naloxone, that works by binding to the same receptors, but it doesn't activate them. And it's competitive, so it kicks out other stuff that's binding to those receptors. So if someone's overdosing, you give naloxone, it'll kick the other drugs out of that receptor, and they'll wake up. If they don't have any opioids in their system, it won't really do anything. So the fentanyl here, it's used safely in hospitals everywhere, but as I mentioned, the media, there's like a lot of fear surrounding this because it is 100 times as potent as morphine, but all that means is that it pretty much has, it'll have the same kind of effects just at a lower dose, a much lower dose. And so it's not that it's like inherently more dangerous at an appropriate dose, but it must be diluted, and it's contributed a lot to a lot more overdoses because, as you know, drug dealers, illicit ones, are mixing this into their supply. If they make a small error in how they dilute it, that can lead to a big dosing error and, you know, people getting too much. More fear, from 2015, the DEA sent out information to law enforcement saying that, you know, talking about how potent it is and that it, like, be careful when doing busts because exposure through, like, a little bit in the air and or on your skin, if it's if you're exposed to it, can kill you. And after this, there were police body cam videos that were released, and you know, they would show like officers doing a bust, and one of them like getting near fentanyl, and then suddenly getting faint, collapsing, and their fellow officers would rush and give them naloxone, and they'd start to get better so that they would be saved. But they use these videos to promote the fear around it. But there's a problem in that fentanyl doesn't aerosolize. It doesn't get in the air. You can't like absorb it through the air. Like, you can't overdose that way. And it doesn't really absorb through the skin without, like, unless it's in a special form, like a patch where they've used heroic chemical measures in order to make it absorb through the skin. If, like, what the DEA said here was true, that it was so dangerous, just a little tiny bit in the air could kill you, then the drug dealers themselves would be dying left and right. It's not happening. And the police descriptions are, have been things like, I couldn't breathe. I thought I was dying. My body shut down, and really lots of distress. And that doesn't match the overdose symptoms, where you might nod off and feel like you don't care if you breathe. You're just breathing more slowly. But it does match symptoms of panic attacks. So these police may have been victims of false information and fear just as much as, you know, even while they were perpetuating it themselves. I wanted to talk a little bit about cannabis binds to cannabinoid receptors, so it's another receptor sort of deal. But it's less understood than the mu opioid. The context here is kind of interesting because in the U.S. it's an illegal gray area, I guess. Like in various states have decriminalized or legalized it for various purposes. I mean, medical and or recreational. But federally, it's still Schedule I. So technically, it's illegal everywhere still. And that makes it very, it's just not enforced, but it's still very difficult to do actual research on. Of course, you might have the impression that actually quite a bit of research has been done on it, and that it helps with like all kinds of things, a long list of conditions. It's even claimed, there's even claims for it to, that it helps autism. But when you actually look at the science, so this report is from 2017, there's only four conditions here that they found any decent evidence for. There's been some like weak studies of some other things. Most of this stuff is hypothetical, and the autism thing just comes from, it's an idea, it doesn't come from research, it comes more from the idea of wanting to sedate your autistic kid. But you know, since cannabis is all natural, it's okay, it's better than giving them a different sedative, apparently. Generally speaking, if a drug is claimed to do all sorts of great things, it's probably not true. There's no panaceas. I think in our culture, well, yeah, medical use is, you know, considered legally and culturally legitimate. But recreational use is kind of, there's a stigma. It's getting better, but there's still stigma. And I think that's really unfortunate. As far as I'm concerned, it should be as legal as alcohol, tobacco, and there shouldn't be a stigma. And the push for legalization is, I think it's as a result of this, has focused on the medical and not the recreational. It's kind of avoided the recreational. So I think a lot of the medical claims involve some motivated reasoning and wishful thinking. And I, you know, now with legal changes, marketing is also involved. There's a lot of marketing efforts. There's quite a bit of money to be made on cannabis products. I mean, medical use is a more important thing, but it's also higher stakes and requires more evidence. I mean, for recreational use, it's just like, yeah, did you have fun? Well, okay. you know, know whatever risks there are. There are some risks, but so we shouldn't believe medical claims just out of motivated reasoning. And cannabis products is also a bit of a wild west out there with regulation. I mean, given the legal stuff, there's a lot of products, and who is, if they say something is on the package, you know, a certain dose or certain ingredients, who's verifying it? Just the manufacturer right now, unless something happens after the fact that brings it up. So no one's verifying. You just have to trust the maker of the specific product right now. And that's also an unfortunate thing. Well, let's talk about serotonin. It's one of the older neurotransmitters. It has its hand in everything. It's everywhere, like JavaScript. There's 15 types of serotonin receptors, and the psychedelic drugs, the ones that are considered hallucinogens, have a chemical structure that looks like serotonin. And on this slide, kind of, you know, you can see psilocybin from shrooms and LSD. And because of that structure, they bind to serotonin receptors, and their psychedelic effects seem to have to do with receptor 2A. And they have some pretty dramatic effects on the brain network, on sensory processing, and consciousness. The sensory stuff isn't the main reason they get attention, because people talk about having deeply meaningful experiences, viewing their lives in a different way, gaining insight, and having fun. Enlightened. So naturally, there's an interest in psychedelics in medicine. And again, I think there's a little bit of like, you know, well, let's try to get it legalized through medical use. But there's a natural interest in them for medicine for mental conditions like depression, like which, you know, still have, there's like an unmet need to be able to treat that better. Our current treatments take a few weeks to work and don't help everyone. But in medicine, we need consistent outcomes. And I'll share an anecdote. I knew one person who was depressed and took shrooms for fun, and they had a great experience where they saw the beauty in the world, and they believed life was worth living just for that, and it was wonderful. They weren't depressed anymore for a few weeks. It came back later. There was another person who was depressed, took Shrooms were fun, and it brought down all their mental defenses. And underneath those defenses, they believed they were a bad person. And that's a symptom of depression. And 2 weeks later, they made a suicide attempt. So in medicine, we really want to know how to get the first outcome and not the second outcome. We need a consistent risk versus benefit. And it seems that, despite the mind-expanding effects, these drugs don't automatically resolve, underlying issues. There has to be more. So the current research is focused on using these in conjunction with psychotherapy, which is, good, but there are complications to therapy and studying that in conjunction with the drugs. And I'll get more into that later. I'll do a quick shout out to ketamine. It's not known for being a serotonergic drug, and we don't really know how it works, but this recently became, in the past decade, became the first new drug shown to help depression in decades. And it works quickly, and this is without therapy. It doesn't seem to be through its mental effects that it works. It seems to be some other reason. So that's a really intriguing research point. It'll be interesting to find out more about how that actually works. And I'm going to actually talk about quite a bit about ecstasy I'll say in a minute. As far as how it works, it floods the synapse with serotonin, and it does this in several different ways. It binds to the transporters on the vesicles that usually package up the serotonin, and so the serotonin doesn't get packaged up, it's just free in the neuron, and then it reverses the reuptake transporter, so that serotonin gets pumped out of the presynaptic neuron and into the synapse. It also inhibits the breakdown of serotonin so that it stays there, it doesn't get taken back up, it doesn't get broken down, and it even binds to serotonin receptors itself. So it's a pretty powerful serotonergic drug. It has some effects on other neurotransmitters too, but its effects on serotonin are what we think is its main effects. And of course, it's not called ecstasy for nothing. It causes a lot of euphoria, but it's not a narcotic sleepy high like opiates. It's more social. It's known for people feeling more empathic, having more compassion, feeling closeness with other people, feeling trusting, having a desire to touch and cuddle. It can dramatically ease anxiety and fear, even making them go away for a while. It increases acceptance of people, even yourself. So the idea of using it to treat certain mental illness, such as PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, is kind of a no-brainer. PTSD is a response to trauma, and famously, war veterans can have PTSD from being in explosions or other dangerous, life-threatening situations. But it can also happen to victims of sexual assault or child abuse, or even people who've been in a bad car accident, really any kind of trauma. And it involves a lot of an overwhelming and disabling amount of fear and anxiety. PTSD patients can mentally relive the traumatic event, they can be suicidal. It can be bad enough. For some people, it's a matter of life and death. And it is another illness where, or condition where there's an unmet need. There are current treatments, serotonergic SSRIs in conjunction with therapy that can help, but they don't help everyone. Therapy for PTSD can be very difficult because if you're trying to talk out and resolve this traumatic event, it's inherently difficult to talk about and can cause panic attacks. So the idea, the hypothesis is MDMA can quiet down this fear and stress and should have a good chance of making the therapeutic process much easier. There's an organization, the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, MAPS, that has they first started investigating MDMA-assisted psychotherapy back in 2001. That's when they put in their investigational drug application. They study other psychedelics too. But for the PTSD, now they have a subsidiary. They later created a subsidiary, Lykos Therapeutics. So when I talk about Lykos Therapeutics, that's who they are. They've been researching this. And in 2017, Lykos is working with the FDA to help design phase 3 clinical trials. Clinical trials happen in phases, and phase 3 is the last one. So it usually happens with pretty promising drugs. They agreed upon the endpoints they would use. They want to try to get this drug approved. They completed those trials, those phase 3 trials, and published them, and they were successful. They met their endpoints. And this year, in February, the FDA accepted their new drug application and gave it priority review so that a decision would be made by August 11th. This year. To give a little bit more about the trials, they're randomized control trials, double-blind, MDMA-assisted psychotherapy versus an inert placebo with therapy. They both had, the endpoint was on the CAPS-5 scale. The response was considered a 10-point reduction in the score, which the score is based on the PTSD symptoms. And there were a lot of responders even in the placebo group, but the MDMA group did basically twice as well in both of the phase 3 trials. It was a pretty large effect size. There was also a long-term follow-up to see if the effect was durable, like 6 months to 2 years later, it seemed like it. In June, on June 4th, an FDA advisory committee, and this was in the media, recommended against approving it. Specifically, they voted 9-2 that saying it was, the current evidence does not show that it's effective, and 10-1 that the benefit does not outweigh the risks. This isn't the decision yet, this is just a recommendation, and the FDA doesn't need to follow it, but it's been very frustrating to researchers and other advocates. I admit, when I first heard about this, this was actually a really large effect. Like, even if there's like some bias or whatever in here, it seems pretty good in PTSD patients. It's life and death. And it is easy to believe like a powerful drug can have a powerful successes. I thought maybe this panel was biased anti-drug. at first. But I looked a little deeper. It's good to always look into things, like why did they recommend against this when it seemed so good? There's actually quite a bit of transparency. The meeting is available online, all 9 hours and 44 minutes of it. I didn't watch all of it, but I did watch part of it. An FDA advisory committee, by the way, it's not the FDA. It's a panel of outside experts who've been nominated for this role. It includes a consumer representative, a patient representative, and a non-voting industry representative. It also includes, during the meeting, a public hearing, and they accept, before the meeting, there's a period where they accept public comments to be submitted in writing. And for this one, there was a citizen's petition for an extended open public hearing. I believe the public hearing part was actually an hour and 45 minutes instead of the usual hour. So a lot went on in this meeting. And there were a lot of issues with this research. First of all, the trial was supposed to be blinded, but you can imagine that if you involve a powerful drug like MDMA, it's hard to blind it. And they did a survey of the participants afterward, and in the MDMA group, 94% of them had correctly guessed which group they were in. In the placebo group, 75% of them correctly guessed. They didn't survey the therapist, but I'm going to guess that it's pretty likely the therapists could tell which of their patients were getting the real doses. So it was functionally unblinded. And this is a problem because it can introduce bias. There was also a selection bias in the participants. 40% of them had used MDMA before in their lifetime, which is much higher than the general population. So basically, the people involved in the trial weren't people who were objective going into it. And that creates a risk of bias. As far as the long-term follow-up, there was about 25% of the participants dropped out, didn't respond to that. So that's another possible selection bias. And the ones who did respond, they had, there was no don't use any other interventions in between. Some of them had in between the end of the trial and the follow-up used other therapies or even MDMA in some cases, their own illicit supply. So that makes it hard to say that if they were doing well, that it was definitely this treatment, the trial, and not something they did later. But I'd say the biggest sticking point, especially in the commentary and the issues, wasn't actually the MDMA itself, but it was the therapy. Therapies kind of regulate therapy. They would, if approved, they would have a what's called a REMS, a risk evaluation and mitigation strategy for MDMA, which can put constraints on how it's used. Like it can require that that during an 8-hour dosing session, a certain number of providers are available, things like that. But it can't, it doesn't say this kind of therapy or those types of specifics, not really the purview of the FDA. And Lykos didn't use a standard validated therapy. They have their own, they have their own manual, they encourage, and so there's some issues that people brought up. One is they encourage the use of touch during therapy. That's very not standard. They say it has to be non-sexual. But on MDMA, you can imagine that this is a very vulnerable situation, that there's a high risk because there's a power imbalance inherently between the therapist and the patient. In these trials, they had two therapists for each patient to try to reduce risk of that. But you can imagine that they're, with someone who is, really inebriated, they are, there can be issues, thorny issues with consent and boundaries and possible boundary violations when you're, using touch. And the risk of sexual assault is not theoretical. It happened in an earlier phase two trial in 2014. MAPS has essentially said basically that it's a couple of bad apples. They kicked those therapists out of the program and everything. But the participant has said that, she's concerned that nothing has really changed systemically, and she thinks systemic safeguards really need to be in place. Because it's such a big risk of happening. And she didn't even remember much of what had happened during her dosing sessions until she saw the videos later. So it's a pretty disturbing case. There were definitely public comments at the committee meeting. There were definitely public comments from people who were very much helped by the treatment and advocated for it and felt that it was a really good thing for them. But there were others who testified to harm. And I think, I want to read some parts of a comment from one participant who also went into this. She's a licensed psychotherapist and trauma researcher, but also has PTSD. While I was in the study, there were many things in my trial therapist did, things I would never do as a therapist or researcher. It includes things like encourage me to view my worsening symptoms as evidence of healing and spiritual awakening, seeding mistrust in mainstream psychiatry, talking about past life traumas, encouraging and one time pressuring me to cuddle with them, repeatedly telling me I was helping make history and that I was part of a movement, and letting me know how my responses and behaviors during and after the trial could jeopardize legalization. Over a very intense 3 months period, while I was being given suggestibility enhancing drugs, my therapist systematically engaged with me in ways that influenced me to become a representative of the movement to legalize MDMA therapy, and shaped my behavior as a research participant, and therefore shaped the data I provided through self-reports. I even changed my voting behavior in a federal election that took place while I was enrolled in the trial. I voted for a party whose platform I explicitly disagree with, but who my therapist verbalized explicit support for. 3 months after I was giving my first dose of MDMA, I was, for a time, one of the staunchest advocates for MDMA therapy. These very sudden changes in my beliefs, values, and behaviors, even in some aspects of my personality, are mystifying to me because these kinds of changes and the direction those changes went in are wildly out of character for me. They are even more mystifying because at the same time that I was turning into a firm advocate of MDMA therapy, I was also relentlessly suicidal and was clinically decompensating in a, frankly, spectacular way. And to be clear, she was in the success group. And she's not the only participant who had experiences like this. It seems that, it was interesting, a lot of these comments were people who still believe in the potential of MDMA therapy, assisted therapy for PTSD and are pro, but were at the same time saying, yay, this can have, can cause harm. There was a man who actually had a informal, not part of the trial MDMA experience in 2022 that he said was so good for his PTSD, and then he participated in a trial later and said he became non-functional, this can really cause harm, and that he really is pro, but in any case, even with a large effect size, there's a lot of concerns that really call the results into question. And I can see why the committee thought the current evidence doesn't show that it's effective. It doesn't mean that it's not effective. We can't say that. We just don't know. There's complications in this evidence, so we really don't have good evidence to say, yeah, it's definitely effective. These trials are pretty much as controlled as it gets. So with some of these issues, I can see why the committee was worried about risks. If it's approved and released, where it'll be much less controlled, even with the risk mitigation strategy. It's clearly, MDMA and other drugs like it, some of the drugs I've talked about are clearly powerful tools that can hack the mind, but we're still figuring out, especially in medicine, where we need consistent results to judge risk and benefit, to actually recommend it to patients. It's a higher standard in a way than letting someone just take it for fun, which I don't think there's anything inherently wrong with that. But for medical use, it's not there yet. The FDA might still approve it, or they might not. And if they don't, it's a setback, but the research will keep moving forward, and I really do hope they resolve some of these issues. We want to hack the mind, in this case, we want to hack the mind of PTSD patients to resolve this, terrible, condition that's disabling them. But we don't want to hack the mind in the wrong way, where people are, in these trials and develop this blind trust and this closeness to their therapist that maybe actually go against their previous values. To wrap up that, I'd say be careful. Like I said, when I first ran into this issue, I thought why did they vote that way? But now I kind of get it. And I was worried about time, but there's still a little bit left. That's all I have for you. I wanted to say, so thank you for coming. I actually am starting a YouTube channel, so I'll do a little shameless self-promotion here. There's nothing there yet, though, except a little trailer, but I am working on a video about the MDMA and PTSD. I ended up when I was writing this speech, I ended up digging in so much and learned a lot about it. So that'll be my first video in a couple weeks. So I guess there will be some time for questions.
Hello, thank you for that. Could you perhaps tell us a little bit more about what the trials were? Because a lot of people, drugs on TV, it's like, here, take this magic pill, you're done. These studies that are before the FDA include the dosage as well as the therapies that go along with it. And that's what they're looking at, saying you haven't got that right for helping people. So could you tell us a little bit more about like whether it's a party dose or a higher level of dose, and what kind of therapies? You sort of described some of that.
Yeah, I mean, they took a pretty standard dose, but they did a split dosing. I think it was something like 80 milligrams and then 80 milligrams a couple hours later. If the patient was feeling okay, there were three dosing sessions. There were three prep sessions where they'd interview the patient. And then there were three sets of dosing sessions where they had an 8-hour dosing session with two therapists, and then three integration sessions after that. And they did the split dosing. If there was a problem after the first dose, they didn't give the second dose.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks so much for giving the talk. If you're talking about, so can you speak a little bit about the chemical differences and like long-term effects of like performance enhancing drugs versus like street methamphetamines?
Which kind of performance?
Like Adderall, Vyvanse, Concerta, like that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Well, those are stimulants chemically. And long-term, they can be not good for the body. In the use of the prescription drugs, they've made sure they're lower risk. This actually, like for the risk of MDMA, they compared it to the risk of meth and Adderall and Ritalin, and it had a lower risk than meth as far as like complications, hospitalizations, but higher risk than Ritalin and Adderall, because those drugs do have some risk, but the risk has been minimized by the way they're used medically.
I mean, aren't they just, they're essentially speed though, right? I mean, they're not really that different from meth you can buy on the street, or is that not true?
Adderall, it's an amphetamine. It's a little less potent because it doesn't have the little extra methyl group that methamphetamine. Half-life is probably a bit different. But what keeps the risk under control is the constraints on usage when it's done in the medical context.
Thank you.
Hi. Two questions. One, specifically for ecstasy, like what is a safe frequency of use? And then two, for sources both of information and safe, clean versions of ecstasy and these newer like 2CB, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. I don't want to read Arrowhead for hours. Like how can I safely find information and source novel things?
Yeah, it's tricky. So the first part of the question, safe frequency, it's a tricky one. It's not really outlined yet. In this study, it didn't have, except where there were some allegations of them encouraging people to use their own supplies after the trial. But it's just, the three doses that they did with the spacing of, 3 weeks, was it, apart. It's not like frequent enough, or like just three doses that could be safe probably. But the parameters of how, like, I don't have an answer for like, well, could you use it once every 2 weeks for a year? I don't know. That seems like it would be probably pretty heavy usage. Could you use it once a year? Probably. But there's not really, most of the information we have is just on street use to begin with. And there was some unknowns with cardiac risk coming up in the trials too. So as far as finding information, there are harm reduction organizations. There's also arrowhead.org. I don't know if you've heard of them, but they have, it's not like the DEA website that's all like, ecstasy causes euphoria and depression, and they make it sound like it feels terrible, and obviously people wouldn't use it if it were like that. So I don't know, did that answer your question, kind of, or?
So just like the first person accounts on Arrowhead is kind of the best there is for information and sourcing on including novel things like 2CB. Like, I hear about this, haven't tried it, no idea how to evaluate if it's safe or where to find clean versions of things.
Right. I mean, it is difficult because the AR are illegal, and so like information is a difficult thing. And comes a lot from, users. And some of it is simply not known. Like there's a history of use of MDMA that goes back a long time, 2CB as well. So you can surmise that, it's probably, relatively safe. You can look at the number of deaths and what they were from. There are risks, but it's still a little bit in the dark.
And sourcing, no useful advice? Too controversial?
Yeah. I mean, Arrowhead is, what was that?
I was just wondering, you touched on one of the concerns with the advisory group at the FDA seemed to really focus on the issues with the trials on MDMA revolving around psychotherapy in conjunction with the use of the medication, and the fact that the FDA doesn't really have anything to say about psychotherapy. So they were questioning, whether or not there was useful data that didn't involve that, because if it depends on the psychotherapy, how can they have input on it? I was just wondering, a lot of these psychedelic trials seem to connect that component, like you use the medication in a controlled environment or with assisted psychotherapy. And do you have any commentary on going forward with the idea of, do we have to develop new frameworks for how to evaluate medications that are going to be used in such a controlled environment?
I think there's some work to be done on that. Drugs haven't just automatically, well, the ketamine sort of has been found to work well in like a single dose without therapy, but that's not true of, say, LSD. But like the therapy component has its issues, I think that we need to do some work on that. The fact that the drugs are powerful and do it, which is what gives them so much potential, right, is kind of a also part of what makes it really difficult.
Okay, you're going to be glad you stayed. I've been introduced to the topic now 5 decades of psychedelic research, pretty hardcore, from Oaxaca to Peru to shamans, to have a solid background in organic chemistry. If you go to Washington, D.C. today, 3 blocks from the White House, you can buy the world's strongest medicines in the world. It's 3 blocks from the White House. They've totally legalized everything in D.C. So the mushrooms, 12 kinds of mushrooms, 24 kinds of cannabis, and they have, this is just a warning to people, they have a new breed of mycelium mushrooms that make look like ayahuasca in Peru, like going to the Five and Dime. It's so powerful, these things are so strong, you can't believe them. But that's right from Washington. The second part I had to ask is, are all this research is being financed by extreme hard right wingers? The MAPS, they got $1 million from the group. Who are they that gave them the money? Bannon's people.
I forget off the top of my head.
The Mercers. Yeah, the Mercers are the most conservative people in America, and they are financing the MDMA research. So the question is why? The second question is, every single dose of psilocybin used in a clinical trial in America today is through Peter Thiel's pharmaceutical company. And as you know, Peter Thiel is extremely right-wing. So why are they financing these projects?
Well, there's a lot of money to be made in it.
They don't need any more money. Huh? They don't need any more money.
Oh, yeah.
Nobody needs any more money. Believe me, the Merces do not need any more money. They're multiple billionaires.
They don't need any more money, but they want
What's your opinion? Why would they finance the MDMA trials?
I think it's there's an interest because I think there is a financial interest.
They're like 80 years old. They don't need any money.
Did you have an opinion on why?
I'm asking. No one knows. No one has an opinion. Even MAPS doesn't know why. The second question is, why is Peter Thiel, everyone knows, I'm assuming, who Peter Thiel is. Why is he in charge of every single psilocybin dose used in a clinical trial in the United States through his pharmaceutical company, Compass?
That's probably
He does not need any more money either. I'm just curious. I'm asking this.
For the source.
They got away with it. They do whatever they want.
Yeah, were killing people.
Yeah.
The MDA is not going out to kill people. Anyway, I'll leave you with that.
All right. Well, that's all the time we have. So.
I think the easy answer is control, right? It's control. But sorry, Dr. Jen, I just have one question.
Oh, yeah.
I promise this is a softball one. So, for the clinical trials where MDMA was obvious to the blinded versus what group you were in, right? For placebos, what were they giving them?
It's an inert placebo.
So, which kind of begs the question, why wouldn't you give something that had also some psychoactive to mask the obviousness of it? Yeah. That's just something that occurred to me, right?
They tried in some of their earlier phases, but it increased anxiety. It had some negative effects.
Yeah, something that they know that, would be reasonably tolerated, but still, hey, could
they,
this
they didn't
be,
find a good solution.
Interesting. Okay, yeah. Thank you.
All right, thank you.